So welcome to the last hour here of the social data revolution at Fudan. And what I thought I would do is I would reflect on what we did in those 10, 11 hours we spent together. And specifically, I will frame it as questions, which I'm answering mainly myself. So here I am, talking in China about a revolution, about a data revolution, about a social data revolution. So that clearly starts with two questions. What is social data and what is a revolution? Social data has two meanings. One, it is data that we create, data that we socialize, that we share. For example, it could be our geolocation. If I am sharing where I am, or if I'm checking into a restaurant, if I'm sharing what dish I like, that would be examples of creating social data. In China, on Weibo, that's a typical example how people share data, share information, share their opinions, things they care for. The other meaning about social data is data about the relationships between people. Data about the social graph, as Mark Zuckerberg called it, meaning who is connected with whom. And in many cases, that's not a binary thing, whether we are connected or not connected. In most cases, actually, it is a question of degrees. And I might be, in my mind, much more strongly connected with you than you, in your mind, might be connected with me. I view it as that there's one social graph in the world. 7 billion times 7 billion connections. But then the different social networks, they shed light on the different corners in the graph. Here in China, where Facebook is not allowed, of course, we have very few people who are on Facebook. On the other hand, most of us here are on Tencent's WeChat. So Tencent manages to map out the graph, or that aspect of the graph of people who touch China, quite well. And there's actually a study of Tencent looking at the use of WeChat elsewhere. And it primarily turns out to be driven by the overseas Chinese, by Chinese people who then go to other countries and they continue to use WeChat and then convince their friends in the other countries to also use WeChat. So that is social data. Why revolution? What is a revolution? A revolution typically comes with a fundamental shift in power. Has that happened here? And I would say yes. If you think about the shift in power between individuals and institutions, let's say between you here as students and me, if I tell you stuff which doesn't make sense to you, quickly, you will use Baidu and look it up and raise your hand and saying, "Professor, this is not correct." Or think about patients and doctors. That in the past, you show up at the doctor's office and, you know, just listen to what he or she had to say, and that was about it. Now, many of us look up things beforehand on the internet, or maybe ask our friends or friends we don't know, other people on the web, on their opinion, even might be sending in pictures about a skin condition or something like that. So what we are seeing is that the traditional authority, which comes from, "I went to med school and I know what's good for you," that gets undermined by the patient being able to look up things both about their disease, but also about the doctor. The relationship between citizens and government. I live very close here in Shanghai to the headquarters of police. PSB, Public Security Bureau. Now, they, of course, know a lot about the citizens. What do we know about our governments? How do you think the balance of power has shifted between citizens and government? If you think about the United States and the last election, a lot came out about Hillary, where after the fact, unfortunately, it turned out that she might not have always said, you know, the truth or really represented how things actually were. So it is much more difficult to lead a life of a politician now, because ultimately somebody will be observing you somewhere. In the book, I talk about the story about Brother Watch, that official in Sichuan province who was open, if the money was right, to let some inspections go the way the company wanted the inspection to go. I think he was involved in the, what in the United States would be the Food and Drug Administration. Why is it called Brother Watch? It doesn't have to do with the public watching him, at least not a priori. What it meant was that he was seen with fancy watches, with many fancy watches. And so people collected photos which were taken by him at public events. And they started looking at the many different expensive watches he was wearing. And they added his salary and said, no way a poor government employee can have all those watches. Let's for the moment not consider the fact that they might have been fake watches. So they, the citizens, looked at data of the people and found out and made the case, and he was prosecuted, that he actually took a lot of bribes. So this is an example how the power between politicians and citizens is shifting, even here in China. There are other countries, like in Estonia, for instance, where the government becomes e-government. And there are other countries, like in Sweden, where your income, your tax records are public. So we haven't reached the end of full transparency. Of course, the question is whether that's actually something we want. I talked to the co-CEO of a US company called Whole Foods. And he told me that everybody at a given store, think about like your local supermarket with an emphasis on food. Everybody in the local store knows how much everybody else is making. Wow, you might think, doesn't that really lead to unhappiness? Surveys have shown that people at Whole Foods actually are quite happy, more happy than at competing places. So sometimes our notion of sharing data might actually not be correct. So here's an example about social data revolution, knowing how much everybody makes and seeing how that influences behavior. So that's what I mean about social data, and that's what I mean about revolution, which ultimately is a fundamental shift in power. And I would argue it affects everything. I've talked a number of dimensions. Others are retail, where you as buyers, you as consumers now have the ability to look up reviews about the seller, is that alleged seller, about the product. And that very much empowers you to make better decisions. You're no longer such subject to nice slogans which were created by marketing departments, but you can see what other people like you, maybe even people who you like, how they use the product and what they think about the product. So I would argue that 1 billion people is now making purchasing decisions differently based on social data. That's why I call it social data revolution. Data is the new oil. Some people have said, including I said that at the United Nations when they asked me to speak a bit about this data revolution. Now, what do I mean by data is the new oil? What that means is data really is a resource. A resource, maybe the most important resource of the century, but a resource that needs to be refined. So if just somebody hands you over some raw data, it's like if you find some raw oil, some crude oil in your backyard, not all that useful. But there's a whole oil ecosystem, a whole world of many companies with many dependencies that create products people ultimately want to buy from them. And that's why I say data is the new oil. Just like oil needs to be refined, data needs to be refined. That means you collect them, you do stuff to them, and you create products with people ultimately want. There's one key difference, however, between data and oil. And that difference is that oil is a finite resource. So if I use a barrel of oil, it's gone. If I sell it to you, I don't have it anymore, and you have it, and you can do with it whatever you want to do. Data is different. If I share data, that does not mean that I give up the data. I still have access to the data. And people get hung up with the language of giving up data. It really isn't the same as giving up an apple or giving up some oil. You still have those data. And the magic of data, of the social data revolution, is that in many cases, if I share some data with you and you share some data with me, we both have more than we had when we started. So data needs to be refined, yes. Absolutely. That's why I say data is a new oil. Data can create amazing value, yes. Even if it's not clear what the effect really is on the GDP, for instance, we have the feeling that data makes us more productive, that using data products of the refineries helps us make better decisions. Not easy to show such connections on a macroscopic level, on a macroeconomic level. But the key difference is that we are not giving up data by sharing, but we share the data with the refinery, we give to get. And we wouldn't play that game if we didn't get more than what we gave. Now, in that game, one key concept is that of data literacy. I am illiterate here in China, and I tell you, it is painful that I don't even know to read the sign for the bathroom. It is difficult. When, you know, I want to order some food, it really is hard because when the Fu Yuan in the restaurant looks at the menu, of course, you know, she knows what everything means. And I have no idea what anything means. So I know what it means to be illiterate every day, almost every hour here. And my poor friends here, I feel very sorry that I have to ask them for the simplest things just because I'm illiterate. But I'm not data illiterate. So let's talk about what data literacy actually means. I think primarily it means that you can make sense out of data, that you know how to interpret data. So I don't know how to interpret these funny characters here, like on your t-shirt. No idea what they mean. Somebody actually gave me a t-shirt. It says data for the people, and then it has a couple of characters. And I did not dare to wear it because I have no idea what those two characters actually mean. So they might say, you know, the bearer of this t-shirt is an absolute idiot. Who knows? So data literacy means to be able to make sense out of data. And there's more to it. It also means to understand the long shelf life of your data. As opposed to physical products, if you write some notes on a piece of paper, after a while, at least if it's for you like it's for me, I don't find that anymore. And effectively, it's gone, disappeared. I don't have to wait until the papyrus disintegrates. I just don't find anymore. That's typical for physical products. In contrast, data I create, that post where I was very happy maybe with one person at a restaurant, that lives there forever. So in this data literacy, one important question that comes up is, what about our right to be forgotten? So the European Union came up with a right that you should be able to tell the data refineries to remove links that point to potentially negative things about you on the web. So the refineries now need to make the decision if that piece of information where that link is pointing to, if that information actually is in the public good, if it helps other people to know this about you, because if there's something bad about you, it might prevent them from doing business with you because the last 10 people you did business with, you screwed all of them. So maybe it's good for the public to know that, you know, sketchy character, this is his past history. But there might be other cases where the data might be wrong. So you can't delete data. You can never delete data. But you can delete the links to the data. And basically how it works right now is that it's up to Google to make the decision whether removing a link is in the interest of the public, and yes, we will keep that link, we won't really remove it, or whether the interests of the individual, the civil liberties of the individual, are more important than the public interest. So that is just one element of data literacy, that it needs judgment. It's about interpreting data, finding out what the meaning is, and it's also about figuring out and learning what the long-term consequences are of data you might be creating. Another element of data literacy, the third one, is what I call orders of magnitude, of knowing what can be the case and what just can't be the case. By training, I'm a physicist. My dad was a physicist and a physics teacher. So I personally love the curiosity of figuring out how things work and love what we call back of the envelope arguments, where you don't look at the minute details, but you just argue, well, it is an order of magnitude. For example, how many pictures were posted on the web yesterday? Nobody knows. Of course, nobody knows. But we know it's of the order of a few billion, maybe a billion, maybe 10 billion. It's not 100 billion. It's not just 100 million. But being able to argue that roughly, let's say, each person posts one picture doesn't mean that each person actually posts a picture, meaning maybe only 10% of the people post 10 pictures a day. But that gives you a feeling, maybe a billion, maybe 10 billion. So that arguing of order of magnitude is a third ingredient of being data literate. And then the fourth one is an understanding that all data can be wrong. in understanding of errors. Again, physicists are actually in a good position there because we know that most detectors make mistakes. Whatever the reason is, we are pretty good in coming up with ways of figuring out whether a data point is correct or is wrong. So what does it mean to be data literate? It means, one, to be able to know what is, what cannot be the case. Two is to know the lifetime of data. Three is to know that there are errors in data. And I just misnamed it right now, misnumbered it. But first one actually was to be able to interpret data, to make meaning out of data. Now, most of the data that we get are phygital data. Phygital is the combination between physical and digital. So purely online data is not that interesting. Purely offline data is actually quite rare because most sensors now are in some way connected to the web. So in China, this phygital is called O2O, online to offline or offline to online, emphasizing that it's actually in this connection where the value lies. So we talked already about the social graph. Social graph is about connections between people. Now we talked about O2O, where I argue that most data actually get their value from being a connection between the online and the offline, the physical world. So if you step back and think about the last 40 years, what really happened? For me, the last 40 years were the history of connectivity. In the 1980s, we learned to connect computers. I was an undergraduate then. I was at CERN in Geneva. And it was pretty amazing to be able to log in into a different computer somewhere else, say in Hamburg at DAISY. That really felt amazing. That world of connecting computers, that was the 80s. The 90s was about connecting pages. So it was no longer about the computers. We could assume that the computers were connected. But we now had this new thing, a page that people made that we could connect. And that led to looking at that connectivity structure that led to PageRank, of figuring out from now the plethora of information you have, which one should you rank on top? Which one should you show the user? First, there was no data, so you didn't have to worry about it. And then suddenly there was too much data. So you need to worry about how can we use other data sources to help people make, you know, the right decisions what to see. And PageRank looks at this connectivity structure between pages to figure out how to rank search results. So that was the 90s, where it was about connecting pages. The 2000s for me were about connecting people. In the US, Facebook, here in China, Xiaonei, RenRen, now WeChat, are all beautiful examples of connecting people. Again, it built on having computers connected, and it primarily built actually on mobile phones, because the 2000s for me was a time when the iPhone came first out. The iPhone was just having its 10th birthday pretty soon. And that allowed us to connect people. So we moved our analysis from the box, the computer, to the page, to the person. Now the obvious question is, what's happening now? For me, as you know from the chapter in the book, which follows the chapter on connecting people, the 2010s are about context, are about sensors. No, not with initial C, with initial S, please. So these sensors now, again, take data from different sources and put them together. So the value really is created by combining data from different sources. And that means context in computing, figuring out from the quality of my voice whether you can interrupt me or whether I'm on the roll, maybe figuring out in a photograph of where that might have been taken from the different colors, or even from when people send memos to see whether the voice and the photo matches to where they claim they were. So context is key. Some people say it's not only context, but it's also conversation, which really matters here in the 2010s. I would say that conversation for me is part of connecting people. So that falls in the last decade. And personally, I'm not convinced that this whole bot economy, those chat bots, where instead of entering a query, you can pretend to be talking to a person, but in a very limited way. I personally don't see that that really is that big a deal. From me, for the data perspective, it really is about sensing. It's about figuring out context. That's where I think the 2010s are. Question?
The live streaming, so this new feature of Facebook, which is inspired to Snapchat and also Instagram stories, do you think it's to connect people, or because it's pretty new, this thing, no? So it's something which indeed is old,
I got the question. The question is, what I think about live streaming. I don't get it, but I didn't get Snapchat either. So when I talked 10 minutes ago about GDP and the effects data has on GDP and on productivity, that is my perspective on life as a person, you know, who has more stuff he needs to do than he has time for. So I wonder, why would somebody bother watching some random person live streaming them standing in front of the Eiffel Tower usually? You know? But I'm not the use case for that. So I'm a bit puzzled about live streaming. Why people actually do it. And if we know, even if we knew why they did it, I'm wondering, why are people watching it?
They are watching it because it gives a sense of authenticity in relationships between people who don't know each other for real. But for example, really, like, there is this YouTubers, people on Facebook which are popular and which has this public of 14, 13, 12 years old girls and guys which, like, cry for them and they think they're really in love with them. So in those cases in which they can see them on live, like, the relationship is the closest possible still through the platform. So yeah, it's, and if you ask why do you like these people, those 12, 13, 14 years old will say, because they are authentic, like they're real, like they show you their real inside.
But you are real too.
No, I don't think so.
No? Are you real? Are you real? There was actually one talk at TED this year, which I thought was the worst talk I've probably ever seen. And I happened to sit next to that talk in Vancouver, next to the guy who runs the internet for Apple. And after that talk, it was about reality and quantum phonons and photons traveling through our bodies and shit like that. At the end, he said, are you real? Can I punch you? I said, yeah, are you real? Are you real? So I actually think that every time had its different ways of communication. There used to be pen pals, where, for instance, when I was in high school, we had a school in South Africa, and we wrote letters to people we never met. And then there used to be chat rooms, AOL, in the mid-90s, was thriving on chat rooms, where you can assume a certain screen name, whatever it was, you could change your screen name, and then you could happily chat. So I had a friend, Vinny. Vinny and I went to Stanford together, and we played that game on chat rooms that, let's say, he tried to chat up some girl. So he played the coy student who would, of course, never ask anything, you know, slightly inappropriate. And he said, "Andreas, can you hit her up and ask her whether she wants to do it tonight?" And so he could maintain that, you know, perfectly prudish boy, still finding out whether, you know, she is as prudish as she sounded. So I think these games people have played, they've played forever. And I always said that you can really perfectly project your unfulfilled desires onto those ASCII characters on a screen. It gets much harder when you actually see the person. It is much harder. And when you actually meet with them in real person, that is yet even more difficult to actually, you know, still have those hopes you have about them. When it comes to hiring faculty, I often say that people get hired by mu plus sigma, by the expected value plus one standard deviation. So the less you know about a person, the more, you know, senior faculty can project onto, oh, that person, he will solve all of my problems, or she'll write the best papers in the universe and get our department really famous. You know, once you actually know something about somebody, you know that the probability of them being the next Einstein are actually pretty small. So the secret to getting hired at great universities is make sure they know very little about you so you don't destroy their dreams. So I don't know much about live streaming. So I think your opinions are as good as mine. What I would say is, let's figure out what is the equation of life. Do we want to actually spend time on that? Or do we rather want to go to a concert or be stuck in traffic? So it really depends on which weights you put on the different terms of activities which you could have. So let's, so this was my, so people didn't react to my saying that I think the 2010s are about sensors. It's about context. It's about cameras, for instance, microphones, figuring out what state we are in. Ultimately, in order to reduce the complexity of things which is presented to us, ultimately to show us those things which are more relevant than others. Now, whether we call this helping people make better decisions, or whether we call this manipulation, that's, I think, just a question of our language. Ultimately, I hope that those refineries that show people data that in the long term are better for them, which they appreciate more, in the long term that have less regret for them, that those are the refineries that will be more likely to be visited by people. So we have all this data, and we have that revolution. What I now would like to do is, I would like to remind us and walk you through the six data rights, and for the first time, show for each right, which is presented from the perspective of the consumer. Show for each right what I think the companies should be doing in order to gain some competitive advantage. So let's start with the first right, the right to access your data. So it's pretty clear, if somebody collects data about you, I want you to be able to look at those data. That's right. Obama said the same thing last year. In the EU, for a number of years now, citizens should be able to look at the data the government has about them. All right? Clear? That's the right. How do now companies can distinguish themselves from other companies? And I think it's by the tools they provide for the user. If a company just dumps out the raw zeros and ones, not all that useful for me. If, on the other hand, a company does a great job in trying to visualize and to contextualize the data, to show my data in comparison to others, and to have me realize things about myself I might not have even known, I think the companies that have the better tools, where better is defined for the user, are the ones where I get more out of the access to my data. So just having access, I think, is a table stake. Getting meaning out of access to data is where companies should compete. A couple of nights ago, I showed to a friend google.com/history, which has my geolocation history. And it is pretty amazing that you can pick any day of the last many years, and it tells me in minute details where was the day, where I was moving, where I was staying. So that's an example of a very, very good way of visualizing an important part of data the refinery collects, namely my geolocation. So the right to access for companies, whether it's big companies or a small startup, the question is, what tools do they provide so my access actually is something which I appreciate? Second right is the right to inspect the refineries. So to remind you, that meant that I get a feeling about what security risks do they face. And that gets computed, for instance, by how good are they in patching up their system? Do they have two-factor authentication for emails that employees want to read? And stuff like that. So what can a company do to score well on that second right, the right to inspect the refineries? I think the answer is not complicated. They have to do well on those dimensions that I outline. So for example, one of these dimensions is the return on data. How much do I get in exchange to what I give? And by doing a good job, by doing a better job than another company, of really giving me what I value, it's the perceived value for me and the perceived cost for me. That's, I think, the bottom line for that right, how companies can distinguish themselves. So just by being good and those variables that I say, that's what the inspectors of the refinery are looking at and sharing with the public, that's how you should actually compete. So think about cars, for instance. You can only do that much in telling people about Fahrvergnügen or whatnot. Ultimately, there are hard numbers like fuel efficiency or safety standards which are being held. So it's not about window dressing, it's about actually improving the KPIs, if you will, that matter to the consumer, the KPIs of the refinery. The third right is the right to amend. So there, what can a refinery do? And the answer is, and now I'm quoting Jeff Bezos, to make it trivially easy for people to contribute. So by removing the friction, by not having people fill out lengthy forms about their identity, make it really easy for them to amend data, ask the best a refinery which distinguishes itself or wants to distinguish itself can do for the user. And the second element about the right to amend is, of course, what does the refinery do with the data that consumers produce? And there I would say that those who use the $100 billion engine of Silicon Valley's advertising, Facebook, Google, those who do a good job in surfacing the responses of other users, the amendments of other users, those are the ones who I think will create competitive advantage out of the right to amend. The fourth right is the right to blur. And I think one example is that of geolocation, that I expect a company, if I say, do not reveal where I am with a granularity of finer than 1,000 kilometers, I totally expect them to respect me for my wish. So I have the right to tell the company not what they measure. I assume that they measure the data with ultimate precision, but what they do, on what granularity they process the data. So that is a bit more tricky to see how that right can actually be used in advantage of the company. For me, that more falls into the category, like in America, there is this do not call lists. And if people violate this, then there are fines. Europe has fines for what company do if they sell personal information. Just in China last week, there was I think Jingdong example, where Jingdong's database got hacked. And I read in the news that for about 1,000 kuai, you can buy lots and lots of personal attributes about people. I'll share those two articles with you. So for me, this falls in the same category as somebody stealing a bicycle. If somebody steals a bicycle, certain things kick in. If the person gets caught red-handed, then probably he has to pay a fine. Maybe he ends up for a night in prison. If he does it again and again and yet again, worse things happen. Or if a company gets, found out that they produce fake medicines, that they say they produce a medicine or they provide some treatments against cancer, but in reality, they just fake it, things kick in, fines kick in. And one open question here is with Baidu happening last year, whether the platform where that happens should be penalized or whether it's only the person who lies about what they're providing, the company who needs to get penalized. So I reduce the right to blur from the company side to respect towards the consumer. But if you violate that respect, if you do things wrong, the usual machinery of the legal system kicks in. The fifth right is the right to experiment. That I have a lot more to say about than just this little aspect of right to blur. And you could actually argue that the right to blur is one such experiment. That you say, well, dear Baidu, if you knew my geolocation really by the centimeter, what would you do with it? How will that change the products which I see from you? So, right to experiment means I can play with the knobs. And one of the key knobs, as you remember, was that trade-off between exploitation and exploration. Exploitation meant that the things that kind of worked in the past, I do more of. Exploration means I try new things, which might work better and might work much worse than the other ones. And that trade-off between exploration and exploitation, I think, is one of the knobs which you should hand over to the user. Don't try to double guess whether he or she wants to go to the same restaurant they always want to go to. Let them decide whether tonight they're up for something entirely new or it is a first date with somebody, so let's better be safe and have the same food we had on the last 10 dates with people and maybe hope that this one will work out better. Let's actually look at the last right, the sixth right, the right to port. And let's look at what companies can do there to distinguish themselves. I would say it is an easy one for companies, again, to make it, again in Jeff Bezos' expression, trivially easy for the user to say, I want this part of my history with you, of the data I created on your platform. I want that in a secure way with PGP, with encryption, to be sent over to that other company so they can play with it. And then I can make the decision whether I like your product better or that other company's product better. So the right to port, relatively straightforward, relatively measurable. So this set in parallel the six rights and the review of them and what companies can do to do better, to win your business, to potentially, and I'm not a big fan of that term, improve their bottom line. Now, I want to look at another perspective of the last 40 years. And that goes AI, BI, CI, and DI. So the 80s was an attempt to AI, to artificial intelligence. I remember taking Taro Winograd's class on Introduction to AI in 1986 when I first arrived at Stanford. And that was a very data-poor world. Terry did his thesis at Shirdlu on having, you know, robots negotiate how they pick up blocks. Data really wasn't part of the game. AI at that stage was coming up with assumptions. Some people call it assumption intelligence. Coming up with assumptions that help us deal or solve relatively artificial problems. What else could we do? We didn't really have data. Remember, that was a decade, the 80s, when computers got first connected. Very little in terms of data. The 90s, I call the decade of BI, of business intelligence. That's the time of SAP and of other vendors who come to you and say, you know, buy my package and we'll tell you how you can optimize your business processes. I see many of you smile here. Seems to be resonating with those vendors showing up. And then a radical shift. The 2000s period of CI. You might be wondering, what is CI? Customer intelligence. But not as those vendors who try to sell you the CRM engines, tell you intelligence about your customers. No. Intelligence by your customers. It was about 10, 12 years ago that Tim O'Reilly coined the term Web 2.0, Web 2.0. And that meant a web which is not the old web, where authorities published pages, but a map that democratized the consumption, the production of information, where anybody and everybody could participate and could actually generate and create content. So when I say CI as the 2000s, it's customer intelligence where people produce the data. It really was when the data of the people and the data by the people could become significant enough to become data for the people. So that was the 2000s. Now what the 2010s? I call it DI. Data intelligence. Yeah. It's about the data, being intelligent about the data. But remember, from the very first beginning of this class, when I talked to you about the value of data is in the decisions that are based on those data. So we might also call it decision intelligence. And I actually like that better than data intelligence. Sometimes people ask me what I think about big data. And I think it's not a big deal. I know that the Chinese book has the term big data for all, literally translated, but it is not about the size. I don't care about the size of the data set. Maybe it is about the variety of different data sets, because we saw that value often gets created by combining different data sources. But for me, it is not about the data. It's about the decisions you make based on the data. And the decisions you make based on the data, not the decision the data makes. Some people say, oh, we want to be data-driven. I do not want to be data-driven. I want to drive. I'm very much in sync with Sartre, Camus, the French existentialists, that we are the decisions we make, not sitting in the backseat and having data drive, but us being able to ask questions to which data help us find the answers. Which brings me to what is the difficulty, what is one of the challenges in this world we live in now, in the world where we have all the data that we ever wanted. Many of my classes, Stanford and at Berkeley, I've asked my guest speakers one question. And I want to share that question with you as well. That's the question about if you had all the data in the world readily available at your fingertips, what would you do with it? I can share with you that many of the companies I work with, whether it's major airlines, insurance companies, retailers, health companies, or startups, particularly startups, they always fall into that trap of saying, gee, you know, if we only had those data, all of our problems would be solved. Impotence, flat feet, hair loss, not a problem. If we only had those data. And so it's a very liberating question to say, imagine you had those data. What actually would you do with it? Because it removes the questions and lifts them up to the right level, which is the level of creativity. What would you do if you had these data? And if the answer is, don't know, I just, you know, thought I'd ask for the data just in case, then that's not good enough for an answer. So I think the bottleneck now is a different one. It's no longer data, it's creativity. It is asking good questions. Now that is very, very hard to teach. And maybe the way to learn how to ask good questions is less in a classroom where somebody pontificates here. It's more in apprenticeship. So like when you do a PhD thesis, most of it is like you hang out with your advisor and you see what he thinks about, what questions he asks. And then you get a feeling about, huh, this seems to be really interesting to him. And you get interested in that as well. And it certainly is not the, you know, frontal, I'm the sage on stage, I'm telling you what to think approach, which gets people to ask good questions. In Asian cultures, I think questions are underrated. in post-war Germany, questions were very important because there was very little that, you know, we could build on after the Third Reich. So we learned to question. We learned to question authority. We learned to ask questions to documents, to texts. And I am a big fan of saying undergraduates learn to answer questions. Graduates learn to ask questions. And that's particularly important in a world where we do have Google and Baidu at our fingertips, where with just a few keystrokes, we can get answers to any question. Whether they're right or wrong, that is a different question. So coming up with that mindset of the importance of question allows us to create possibilities. A couple of months ago, I had the CFO of Deutsche Telekom visit me at my house in San Francisco. And he made the point that in Europe, most people are concerned with the downside, with the left tail of the distribution. If you do this, what could go wrong? And we need to manage that. We need to manage the risk. We need to hedge against the risk. So better not do this because something might go wrong. Then, as he was at my place in San Francisco, he said, in Silicon Valley, very different game. People say, and let's focus on the right tail, the right side of the distribution. What if, you know, the best things happen? What would those be? So, you know, we don't care about what can go wrong. We care about what can go right. Or we don't care if things go wrong, what happens. We care if things go right, what happens. And that's a very different mindset. So I feel that the social data discussion, the social data debate, has focused too much on the trying to talk about values of privacy, of control that emerged in the late 1800s, Brandeis in the United States, and has too little focus on creating possibilities based on these data. So the reason I'm talking about my six rights is that I think if we put those into the ground, it allows us to ask questions again, because to some way, to some degree, having those six rights, I think, capture some of the things which I believe are important for us as individuals, those data rights. And if we get companies to actually agree on those, companies will be more free to create things, to co-create things with us out of the data which we create and which we share.
So how do you think we get the companies to do this, to implement the six rights? By state regulation or market forces?
Yeah. So the question is, how now do we get companies to actually implement those? I think both by us voting with our feet, or voting with our mouse, or with our thumb, or index finger, whatever we do on the mobile phone, that honestly, I have the choice here between Baidu and Google. I vote with my default settings for the search engine. And Robin Lee is a very nice guy, so nothing personal about this. Seeing what tools the companies provide, seeing where do we as consumers get more out of what we put in, what do we get compared to what we give. But I also think that regulation is needed. And you might have heard about that about a month ago. Germany put forth a digital charter for our digital rights. I got an email from Yvonne, who wrote a book on that topic as well, pointing out to me, I'm very happy to forward it to you. I think we actually have talked about it already. Trying to get the EU to adopt some of these rights, just like the United Nations had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in, I think, 1949. Some of those things are non-trivial. For example, the right to port. That is about data mobility. In the EU, one of the key questions is, are we having mobility? Can people work in any member state? You know perfectly well in China, I think it's called Hukou, the area where you are allowed to work. Hukou. Thank you, Robbie. And that is non-trivial. If you have Shanghai Hukou, you're much better off than if you have Urumqi Hukou, or Yunnan or somewhere, you know? Because if you have your Urumqi Hukou, I think it's very difficult to legally work in China, legally work in Shanghai. That's my understanding. And you tell me how it is. Can you, if you have Urumqi Hukou, can you just take the train, move to Shanghai, get a job here?
I think so. But there are some restrictions, like Urumqi Hukou cannot bought Shanghai's real estate.
Ah, they cannot buy real estate. How about your children or your child? Your one child. Do you have the same access to the Shanghai school system if you have Urumqi Hukou? The answer is, in this case, no. So if you want to send your child to the Fudan affiliated school here, you have to be a Shanghai resident. The ability to move, the mobility, is not really there. And an example here is that for schools, you have different privileges if you have Shanghai Hukou for your child compared to if you don't have it. Let's see how we land. So we had the question about the role of law. Law is important. Regulation, however, follows. It doesn't drive innovation. I think it is companies that build stuff that hopefully get used by people and hopefully gets built by companies in a positive way that they try to genuinely move society forward. So I asked you that question. If you had all the data in the world, what would you do with it? And I want to link us back to the very beginning of the very first class, when I asked you to take out your mobile phones and look up your social credit score. And now we assume we have all the data in the world and we know about everything you have. How should we be constructing that social credit score? Going back to the example of what decisions depend on it, let's say Fudan High School decides we do no longer require Shanghai Hukou. We just require the parent's social credit score to be above 780. Would that be fairer? I don't know. But those are the questions of our time. Many of our laws are made from a time before we had data. Hukou being a good example for, you don't need much data. You just need one entry in your residence card of where you are from. But now we have this data. How should that affect fairness? What world do we want to live in if we had all the data in the world available at our fingertips? Two final words of how I think that could happen. And you have heard both of them. One, make the implicit, explicit. So writing down the equation, honestly, which has all the terms, and debating in a public debate, what weights do we want to have in front of those terms, I think is a very important step. In that debate, we will find out whether people and which people prefer that that artifact that you were born in Shanghai should be more important than, you know, whether your father or your mother evaded the train fare once or twice. The wonderful example we had in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago. So making the implicit explicit also means doing data mining and figuring out the biases we have in our decision making. So having the data, making the implicit explicit is one of the two steps. The other step is think about what game you are playing. If we have this transparency, the two transparency laws I have, and if we have this agency for the end user, one big question left is the question, are you playing a zero-sum game, a win-lose game? I win, you lose. You lose, I win. No, whatever it is. Or are you playing a win-win game? And data, particularly social data, gives us pretty much for the first time a resource where the chances of playing a win-win game, of creating a win game, of designing a win-win game are much higher than we ever had in the world before. Any natural resources are win-lose games. If I use a resource, you don't have it. If you use it, I don't have it. With data and the property of data, that it precisely is not like oil when it comes to playing games, when it comes to creating refineries. I think I want to leave you with the hope that when you are thinking here, you as MBA students, when you're thinking about your next business, try to design it that it uses data, social data, in a win-win game and not in a zero-sum game. So I thank you for your attention on these four afternoons here in Fudan. I hope you got something out of it and wish you really all the best. Thank you.